Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 395. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have an incredible show for you this week. As you loyal listeners know, one of my favorite things to do on this show is to highlight just absolutely amazing individuals and amazing organizations doing amazing work. And I have the privilege of doing that again this week as we take a deep dive into AIDS United, an organization whose mission it is to end the AIDS epidemic in the United States. Here to talk all about AIDS United is their president and CEO, Jesse Milan Jr. Jesse is a community advocate and a nationally recognized expert on HIV and AIDS policies and programs. He has put in 30 plus years of experience in executive roles in the public and private sectors and has directed multi-million dollar budgets and staff for federal, state, local, and global public health agencies. Notably, beginning in 2002, he served a five-year appointment as co-chair of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Health Resources and Services Administration Advisory Committee on HIV and STD Prevention and Treatment, and in 2007, he was designated a Fulbright Senior Specialist in Global HIV and AIDS. A lawyer by background, which we will talk all about that, Jesse has received numerous honors, including the 2015 Public Service Award from the Association of Nurses in AIDS Care, and was awarded the Health Resources and Services Administration HIV and AIDS Bureau Administrators Award for his leadership in the global fight against HIV. He has addressed millions of folks on television and radio. He's given so many different presentations. He's been an inspiring keynote speaker at national and regional conferences and at events, including at the White House, and right this second, he's here with us. Jesse, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you for your wonderful work in bringing the voices of people living with HIV and people who are gay and lesbian and transgendered to the world. Thank you.
I have to say that in 395 episodes, I think that your bio had more acronyms and abbreviations than any other bio in the history of the show.
Well, welcome to those of us who work in the federal and foundation arena. We spend a lot of time deciphering acronyms, but we always try to make sure people know what they are.
That's a good thing. Well, let's go all the way back, Jesse. What was the dream when little Jesse was running around? Did he want to be a lawyer?
When little Jesse was running around, people told me I was going to grow up to be a lawyer. In fact, when you asked me that question, I had this vision of when I was 8 or 9 years old, and my favorite aunt and uncle gave me my favorite Christmas present, which was a briefcase.
I love it.
And I carried that briefcase around, I think, for the next 3 years.
There has to be a picture of that somewhere, and we will put it up if you give it to us. That's wonderful. So at what point did you say, all right, sure, I got the briefcase when I was little, but I want to go this route. I think that I can use my voice in this way to make a difference.
Well, I became involved in oratory during my junior high school years, mm-hmm. and then debate in my high school years. And in each of those arenas, the topic that you're speaking on, whether it's debate or as an orator, is usually some sort of socially provocative topic. When I was in high school, we were debating the welfare system and things of that nature. And so I learned to argue and to win, and also to inspire through oratory. So that was a strong trajectory toward going into law. Plus, my father is a former state president for the NAACP in Kansas. So I grew up during the 60s with all that social justice activity literally happening in my own home. So the trajectory to becoming a lawyer was, I think, pretty clear from very early on.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And at some point, I don't know if you would call it a pivot or more of a focus, you really became dedicated. You dedicated your work to HIV and AIDS work, health-related work. Talk to me about that moment of focusing in on that.
Well, there was actually a convergence of things. I was a young lawyer in Philadelphia. I was a labor lawyer. The trajectory that I described around social justice issues took me into labor law, where the rights of employers and employees were paramount, and I was addressing those. As a young labor lawyer in Philadelphia during the mid-80s, I was advising, at that point, the city government of Philadelphia about the HIV epidemic and the rights and responsibilities of the city government. And at the same time, my late partner was diagnosed with HIV, and he died in 1985. And so there was this convergence of what was going on in my personal life and also the work that I was doing in my professional life. And after he died in 1985, I found that the need to do more as a volunteer was growing. And so people kept asking me as a young lawyer to literally go on the stump and start to do community forums and things about the rights of people living with HIV. And before I knew it, I was asked to be on the board of directors of Action AIDS, which is now Action Wellness in Philadelphia. It was during its earliest formative months. And before I knew it, I became president of that board, and then president of another board and another. And it just kept snowballing, and my personal and professional life started taking me in that direction.
You know, Jesse, this has come up so many times on the show in the past, but for our listeners who, you know, might be slightly younger, who hear stories about the 80s and that intersection of the 80s and HIV and AIDS, but can't quite wrap their mind around it, how do you go about describing what the atmosphere was like, particularly as someone who was immersed in this work?
Well, there was a frightening atmosphere. You know, when we all started reading in 1981 and 1982 about this disease that was striking gay men in San Francisco, those of us who were in other cities wondered, well, what's going on there, and are we at risk here? And then as the news reports kept expanding and expanding, the sense of fear grew all across the country, especially in major metropolitan areas where gay men were concentrated. And so we were worried about our own lives and about each other. And by the time we started to know what HIV was and what AIDS was, then we started rallying around each other to not only prevent the spread of the disease, but also to take care of those who were sick and dying. And of course, at that time in the mid-80s, throughout the 80s, people were dying very rapidly, and their deaths were very unpleasant. So we had to really rally around each other.
Wow. You know, for you, as you just alluded to, there is this intersection of public and private life. How do you go about navigating that? You obviously have your own personal story, but then you also have the work. Do you try to keep them separate? Does it depend on the task? How do you approach that confluence?
I think that those of us who are in this work for a long time find it difficult to separate our personal and professional lives from the work, especially for those of us who are living with HIV.
Right.
And when I think about the other leaders of organizations, whether they are local or at the national level, that intersection is very, very strong. In my own case, I met my husband, my spouse of now, Bill, and I've been together for now 28 years. I met him doing this work, and so having someone who supports you in your life's mission is really important, but also someone who can help take care of you to make sure that you aren't always focused on the professional and also focused on the personal. That balance is important, and all of us who do this work have to work really hard to achieve a balance.
I worry about that with you. I think that you take work home with you sometimes.
You are so right. You are so right. But that's because the work is important. And I'm not the only one. When I think about other executive directors and CEOs of HIV/AIDS organizations, I think we all do it, particularly because we're nonprofits. And it's not any different from, I think, many of us who work in the nonprofit and the public sector. We know that the work never stops. And so in order to achieve our mission, we have to make sure that we're always working hard. But it is important to try to maintain a balance.
Okay. We're gonna get at that balance. We're going to get us all to that. It's very important. All right. We have to talk all about AIDS United. How did AIDS United come across your radar?
Well, I had been spending a couple of years in a consultant role, which was a lot of fun, and I had done some important consulting projects for CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, for the National Minority AIDS Council, and also for the Department of Health and Human Services, all doing some very interesting work on HIV/AIDS. And, you know, sometimes we just have to hold out into the universe what is what's next. So in addition to being a consultant, I was also doing some executive coaching and learning and teaching others about being good leaders. And all that seemed to come together when a phone call came from an executive search firm that was looking to find the new interim for AIDS United after the announcement of its previous CEO's departure. And they called me. And for me, it was a very personal and professional aha moment. It was like, oh, this is for me, and I need to go do this. My work in HIV is not completed, but all that I've been doing the last couple of years in leadership development and with these national issues for CDC and NMAC all seemed to work, and it all came together. And I thought, my goodness, I have to say yes, and I did.
I love it. I love it. As I mentioned in the bio, it's an organization whose mission it is to end the AIDS epidemic in the United States. I'm a college professor, so I tend to like my metrics a little bit. How do we go about measuring whether we're making progress towards that, Jesse?
Well, we have to thank the Obama administration for creating the first national HIV/AIDS strategy, which has, you know, three major goals of reducing new infections, making sure people are in treatment and care, and reducing health disparities. And at the time that the National HIV/AIDS Strategy was released, we were also focused on a new, what is called the HIV Continuum, which looks at the number of people who are living with HIV, the number who know their status, the number who are linked into care, the number who are retaining the care, the number who are on antiretrovirals, and the number who are achieving a viral suppression. And that is unfortunately still a very steep slope from the number of people living with HIV all the way down to the number who are virally suppressed. And so we want to ensure through our national goals that everyone living with HIV knows their status, that everyone is linked to care, everyone who needs to should be on antiretrovirals, and that all of us who are living with HIV are virally suppressed. We are not achieving a 100% goal in any of those categories,
right?
None of them. And so that those metrics are our guiding star for what we need to do in order to end the epidemic. And we also need to reduce new infections to zero. So those are our major metrics.
Why can't we just wave the wand and have that happen?
Well, we've been trying to do that for 30 years, more than 30 years. But the good news is that there are biomedical interventions that can make it possible for us to get to zero and to get to 100% viral suppression across the United States. And those biomedical interventions, which include pre-exposure prophylaxis on the prevention side, also known as PrEP, and making sure that people who are infected are immediately getting into care and immediately put on HIV treatment to achieve a viral suppression. By achieving viral suppression, you also reduce your infectiousness and therefore reduce the possibility of transmitting the disease to someone else.
Yeah. So important. Again, listeners, we are here with Jesse Milan Jr. He is the president and CEO of AIDS United. Jesse, what does the president and CEO of AIDS United do?
Well, I think all CEOs and all executive directors are responsible for the same bucket of responsibilities. That includes making sure that the financial health of the organization is always good, making sure that the professional work of the organization is always exceptional, making sure that all of our funders and clients are satisfied, and that we're always looking across the landscape at what's coming to make sure that we are prepared to handle the changes in the environment and also leading the organization forward to navigate through those changes to continually achieve the organization's mission.
Nice. Now talk to me about one of those signature ways that AIDS United approaches this work. What's one thing that you think that AIDS United does really well?
Well, Age United is called United because it's the merger of two historic organizations in the HIV arena, the National AIDS Fund, which was a national organization providing grant making to the HIV/AIDS community across the U.S., and the former AIDS Action Council, which was a leading organization for developing HIV policy at federal arenas. Those two organizations have come together. They did so in 2010 and formed AIDS United. So grant making is one thing that we do this year. From our funders and supporters, we will be giving away approximately $5 million in terms of grants to organizations, community-based organizations and AIDS service organizations and social justice organizations across the U.S. And our policy team is working very hard, particularly since the November election, to continue to advocate for the appropriate policies at the federal level for HIV/AIDS prevention, treatment, and care. So those two signature areas are what we do. And a third part of the tripod of AIDS United is capacity building and technical assistance, helping AIDS service organizations, community-based organizations do better and navigate the constant changing landscape so that they can either sustain themselves, increase their capacity, or if necessary, make hard choices about where their future may be.
Well, speaking of that changing landscape, I don't know if you heard, Jesse, but there was an election back in November that changed some of the power structures here in our country. How is this new administration affecting your work? And you mentioned earlier as well about being prepared for changes. How do you go about doing what it is that you do with a new administration?
Well, with this new administration, we've been working with our partners in the field to listen very carefully to what the administration is saying, what the newly elected Congress is saying, what all the newly appointed cabinet officers and directors of federal agencies are saying. AIDS United has a public policy committee that is made up of 44 of the nation's leading HIV/AIDS service organizations, and our policy work is actually guided by our public policy committee. It includes names that you may recognize from across the U.S., such as GMHC in New York,
right.
AIDS Project Los Angeles in L.A., and AID Alabama. Those organizations come together and they help shape our policy agenda. So we were very heartened when the Trump administration released the outline of its budget just last week and included for the first time in writing that the Ryan White program would remain a priority, and so would the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. Those were really the first time that we had actually heard something direct from the White House around HIV/AIDS. So now we are looking at what that means and how those priorities can actually be sustained, but we are concerned about what we didn't hear, which was how the federal budget appropriations will play that out, not only for the various organizations across the federal government, but how they will be supported with the actual dollars that they need to do the work that we need in order to get to the goals that I mentioned earlier.
It sounds like you're prepared.
We're working very hard, and I have to say that in this new environment since the November election, working in collaboration with our own partners and with new partners across all diseases and across all different interest areas, whether we're talking about women's reproductive health or whether we're talking about larger access to low-income health care, all of those issues are impacting the HIV community. And so we are reaching across all different divides to be in lockstep with our brothers and sisters who have the same goals that we do for all of us to be healthy and whole in the United States.
Well, can we talk about those partnerships for a second? Because when some of us who are a little bit outside of this work look at the landscape of organizations, I sometimes get a little bit nervous. Are there too many organizations? Are they working cross-purposes? Is everybody working together as well as they could? From your vantage point, talk to our listeners about how you go about working with other organizations and whether should we be consolidating? I think you know better than I do.
Well, I think with the financial landscape, we all have to be concerned about who is most sustainable and how can they be sustainable. So one of the grant-making funds that we operate at Age United is called the Sector Transformation Fund, which provides funds to organizations to actually do that very hard analysis that you're talking about. Should this organization change? Should it grow? Should it merge with someone else? Or should it possibly close? And though closing is sometimes a sign of defeat, sometimes it can also be a sign that your mission for your particular organization might have been achieved, or in the options of merging or growing or changing, how you can evolve right. in order to achieve your greater mission. So yes, those questions are happening all across the country, both at local levels and at national levels.
I like hearing that. I like hearing that. You've done so much work with the Black AIDS Institute. Tell our listeners about the Black AIDS Institute and why that work is so important.
Well, I'm a volunteer board member of the Black AIDS Institute, and I spent 7 years as its board chair, and the organization wouldn't let me go, so they gave me the title of Chair Emeritus.
Yay.
Which made me feel really old, really old, and I was not that old. And the Black AIDS Institute, of course, has a specific mission for the African-American community, and I just wanted to make sure that, though I've been working nationally and globally, that I had a specific purpose to address the HIV epidemic for the Black community, because as an African American myself, I felt it was important to do so, and the Black AIDS Institute is the preeminent Black organization nationally for the kind of work that we do.
It's important stuff. Jesse, we have all of these listeners out there, and it's always the question that we get emailed more than any other question of, okay, I now know more, but what do I do, right? We want to give people a plan to action. So for folks who want to support the really important work that you're doing, what can we do? How can we actually make change?
Well, I think one of the things that we can do is to engage in the conversation. I hear all across the country, and especially in the South, how the stigma of HIV is so pervasive, how people are afraid to talk about it, ask about it, find out about it, discuss it with their colleagues and their peers. That may be the most important thing we can do, is to remind people that HIV is not over, and to remind people that you are a supporter of people living with HIV, because you want to support someone to know their status and you want to support them in being in care. You know, Ken, we all have friends and relatives who have heart disease and diabetes, and we talk to them about their disease all the time. We need to be able to help people feel comfortable talking about HIV so it gets out of the shadows and into the light. That's where stigma will dissipate. And then second, I think people need to look at where their passion is. If you are really concerned that people living with HIV are getting food, then you might find that there's a food program that is right for you where you can go and do something, be a volunteer, be a donor. If you're really concerned that people who are feeling disenfranchised vote, there are many ways that you can go and help with voter registration and get people out to vote and maybe even help find new candidates. So find what your personal passion is and go with it, because you won't be a dedicated volunteer or donor if you're not doing something that speaks to your personal passion.
I want you to be one of those candidates. I feel like you were on the verge there of declaring your candidacy for something, but I don't know what yet. We're going to find out. We'll find out.
Oh, Ken, you're too kind.
Now, what does Jesse get out of this work?
Wow. Well, you know, I've had a personal credo that I don't describe very often, but we actually had this in an all-staff meeting. Everyone was asked, what is your personal motto? And I revealed that for decades mine has been, to whom much is given, much shall be required.
Yeah.
And I feel called every day to do what I can do, because there is such a great need out there. And there is great reward in knowing that you've at least tried your best. You know, we can't conquer everything, but there are things that we can conquer in the moment. And knowing that you've tried your best to make a change is what gets me up in the morning and lets me go to sleep at night.
Not that you're bringing work home with you, but that's good. This is a good thing.
Yes, there is work at home.
Now, I have to tell you, one of my favorite aspects of having all of you CEOs and presidents and executive directors on the show is this final question. I give you the floor, sir, to extol the virtues of your staff and the great work that they're doing, because I know you're not doing it by yourself.
Well, I've been with Age United since I became the interim last June and then was made the permanent CEO in November. And every day, our staff, because they're serving the country, our staff does amazing things. They work so hard to make sure that grant opportunities are available. They work so hard to make sure that our grant making is fair and that our grantees are successful. They work so hard in the policy arena to make sure that we are a strong voice for the appropriations, the dollars we need, and the services we need from the federal government, and that unfair laws, even at state levels, like the HIV criminalization laws, are repealed. And now they're working very hard on addressing the American Health Care Act. And our staff works so hard in going out into the field to work directly with community-based organizations to make sure they have the tools they need to succeed. We have a staff of about 30 people, but the number of miles and the number of hours they log each year is just amazing. And that's because they know that we have a great mission and that our mission can only be achieved through them.
There it is. There it is. That's why I love asking that question. Listeners, this is what we need you to do right this very second. Stroll on over to AIDSUnited.org. That's AIDSUnited.org. You will learn all about AIDS United. They have their programs and grant making, policy and advocacy, capacity building assistance, which is so important. And I'm feeling pretty comfortable that Jesse is okay with you clicking on that donate button and supporting them in that way. Is that okay with you, Jesse?
Absolutely. We hope your passion is here to help us with those three areas, because we can do more grants if we have more resources. We can do more work for all of us in this policy arena with this new political landscape, and we can help organizations survive and change if we have your support.
Jesse Milan Jr. is the president and CEO of AIDS United. Again, go visit them at AIDSUnited.org. Jesse, you are doing such important work. Please, please thank your staff. And of course, thanks to you for your years of doing this, your passion, your commitment, and really your ability to just make change and put your voice out there. It's a beauty to behold, sir.
Well, thank you, Ken, and thank all your listeners for being concerned about HIV/AIDS. It's not over yet, but it will be if we all work together.
Past the devil's own temptation, beyond where angels sleep, to the holy invocation of a neon city street. I feel your hand, I hold you. Through your eyes I see my love wherever I go. I take you.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons and tons of time left on this week's episode to cover all of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. But first, have you picked up my book yet? I mean, come on, folks, pick up my book. Just go to Amazon, type in Ken Schneck. The name of the book is Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew. Go pick it up. It's on Amazon. All of our news this week comes to us from Pink News. You can get all your latest LGBTQ news by going to pinknews.co.uk. And you can find out what's going on in England and in Europe, or you can click on US and find out what's going on here. Well, certainly dovetailing with what we've been talking about all episode long, Researchers have said now that humanity is one step closer to a vaccine for HIV after a recent breakthrough. Scientists at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln have engineered an on and off switch onto a weakened strain of HIV. This is allowing them to spread the virus throughout someone's body before deactivating the strain after it has immunized the host. Around 35 million people have died of AIDS since the epidemic began, while 36.7 million are still living with HIV. That's all according to the World Health Organization. A weakened virus is generally preferred by scientists because it has the potential to produce a stronger and longer-lasting immunity in patients. However, weakened viruses, as opposed to deactivated viruses, still possess the ability to replicate and spread disease instead of an immunity. These Nebraska researchers, they began tackling this problem in 2014, and the technique they've developed and written a study about earlier this year could be one of the safest anywhere. One of the associate professors said this quote, "Safety is always our biggest concern. In this case, it means we are one step closer to generating a vaccine." Wow. Incredible stuff. Incredible stuff. So we will keep our eyes on that type of research work happening. Now, let's talk about HIV and AIDS on the national front. Donald Trump and Mike Pence have made proposals to gut the funding for the U.S.'s pioneering HIV and AIDS prevention projects. The bulk of the cuts are proposed to the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, which was set up by former President George W. Bush to tackle the AIDS crisis, and it's one of the largest providers of funding for global projects battling the spread of HIV and AIDS. The White House budget documents, which were supplied to Congress and they were published by Politico, they reveal that Trump and Pence are planning to slash $242 million from that budget. The White House claims the cuts will maintain current commitments and that the savings will come from ending less effective HIV research and prevention activities, but activists say the cuts will cripple global attempts to eradicate AIDS. The budget documents say this, quote, "This reduction would achieve savings by requiring this program to begin slowing the rate of new patients on treatment in fiscal year 17 by reducing support to low-performing countries, by reducing lower-priority prevention programs, or by identifying new efficiencies or other savings." The document goes on to say this, quote, "This reduction would eliminate less effective HIV research and prevention activities and accelerate reductions proposed in fiscal year 2018. As you can well imagine, activists are saying this is going to cripple efforts to combat HIV and AIDS across the globe. But that is not all that is happening with this Trump administration. Quite a bit more is happening. Less than 2 months after directly promising he would not repeal President Obama's discrimination protections for LGBT workers, Donald Trump has quietly revoked part of President Obama's discrimination protections for LGBT workers. Barack Obama signed a series of executive orders in 2014, ensuring that employees of federal contractors are protected by LGBT anti-discrimination legislation after Republicans in Congress shot down legislation on the issue. After taking office earlier this year, President Trump explicitly ruled out a move to revoke the protections. An official White House statement on January 21st, we certainly covered this on the show, said this, quote, "President Donald J. Trump is determined to protect the rights of all Americans, including the LGBTQ community. The executive order signed in 2014, which protects employees from anti-LGBTQ workplace discrimination while working for federal contractors, will remain intact at the direction of President Donald J. Trump," end quote. Less than 2 months later, however, Donald Trump has already slid back on the promise. This week, he officially revoked the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces order that was a key part of protecting LGBT workers. The order previously, because it's gone now, the order required companies that want to do business with the federal government to disclose whether they have been liable for discriminating against people, including against LGBT people. The Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces Order is technically distinct from the Executive Order on LGBTQ Workplace Protections, but the two orders were intended to supplement each other on issues of discrimination. LGBT rights experts say that by repealing the order, President Trump has created a loophole that makes it difficult to enforce any decision against an anti-LGBT company. Lambda Legal, that great organization, their CEO, Rachel B. Tiven, said this, quote, "This sends a message that the government condones discrimination. Scrapping an order like this one is different than not adopting one. It's not surprising, given Donald Trump's sordid history with women, that this administration is allowing companies to hide sex discrimination, including sexual harassment. Furthermore, this administration is inviting businesses to the table that violate equal pay and fair wage laws, ignore laws requiring family medical leave, or target employees for discrimination based on race, sex, gender identity, gender nonconformity, including being gay or lesbian, disability, including HIV, and numerous other grounds. All of these things violate the law. Companies that flout the law should be sued, not invited to win our tax dollars. The Trump-Pence administration is depriving the people of a valuable enforcement tool. Employees of federal contractors should know their rights and contact us," that's Lambda Legal, "and contact Lambda Legal if they are discriminated against. Lambda Legal will sue to enforce the federal laws that protect LGBT employees and employees living with HIV." There you go. But, my friends, that's not all. That is not all the Trump administration is doing. I save the best for last. This is possibly has the most ramifications of anything else going on thus far. President Trump's administration is removing, they are removing LGBT people from official government records. It had been hoped that sexual orientation and gender identity would be included on the USA's next national census due in 2020, but this week the US Census admitted that it had inadvertently included sexual orientation and gender identity, they did it by accident, in a much-awaited report outlining new categories for the survey. There had been a sustained campaign to have the factors included on national records. Last year, various federal agencies urged the Census Bureau to include sexual orientation and gender in their data, saying it was crucial for law enforcement and public services. And GLAAD president, that's the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, their president, Sarah Kate Ellis, has said that there is a, quote, systematic effort on behalf of the Trump administration to erase LGBT people. She went on to say this, by erasing, and folks, you gotta stop here for a second. You have to understand how big this is. This is Ken talking, not GLAAD President Sarah Kate Ellis, but I urge you to pause right here. You're thinking, okay, so there's a category now that's not going to be on the census. It is so much bigger than that, and GLAAD President Sarah Kate Ellis captures this perfectly. This is what she said, quote, by erasing LGBTQ Americans from the 2020 U.S. Census, the Trump administration is adding a disgusting entry to a long list of tactics they've adopted to legally deny services and legitimacy to hardworking LGBTQ Americans. The Trump administration is trying hard to erase the LGBTQ community from the fabric of America, but visibility has always been one of the LGBTQ community's greatest strengths. So, let's pause again. Again, let's get this straight. By erasing these categories from the census, this is how we determine what programs to offer. We base it on demography. I actually took a course as part of my PhD, Demography, Human Rights, and Ethics. About halfway through the semester, I understood finally what demography was. And that's how we count people, how we document the citizenry of a nation. That's how we determine which programs to offer. We're not going to go out there to Vermont and say, well, we are just going to funnel all of our programs for people of color to Vermont. Well, that wouldn't make sense. We do need more support in Vermont for all of our communities of color, but we also know that it is one of the whitest states in the country. And we know that through demography. By no longer collecting information on LGBTQ people, we will have no idea the types of programs to offer. We can offer no substantive proof of where LGBTQ people are living. whether there are wage gaps, what their families look like. We know nothing. I know research is not the sexiest thing. Demography is not the sexiest topic. I have a story on RuPaul. I'm going to get to that in a second. That's a sexier story. But when it comes to providing resources, when it comes to addressing, hey, what's actually happening in the country, we need demography and we need these categories to be represented on the census. And unfortunately, that is not going to be happening anymore. Megan Morey, the Criminal and Economic Justice Project Director at the National LGBTQ Task Force, said this, quote, "Today, the Trump administration has taken yet another step to deny LGBTQ people freedom, justice, and equity by choosing to exclude us from the 2020 Census and American Community Survey. LGBTQ people are not counted on the census. No data is collected on sexual orientation or gender identity. Information from these surveys," it's what I was just saying, but here's the quote from Megan Morey, Criminal and Economic Justice Project Director of the National LGBTQ Task Force, said this, quote, "Information from these surveys helps the government to enforce federal laws like the Violence Against Women Act and the Fair Housing Act, and to determine how to allocate resources like housing supports and food stamps. If the government doesn't know how many LGBTQ people live in a community, how can it do its job to ensure we are getting fair and adequate access to the rights, protections, and services we need? We call on President Trump and his administration to begin collecting sexual orientation and gender identity data on the American Community Survey as soon as possible, and to urge Congress to conduct oversight hearings to reveal why the administration made the last-minute decision not to collect data on LGBTQ people." There it is. We call on President Trump and his administration to begin collecting sexual orientation and gender identity data on the American Community Survey as soon as possible. This is so, so important, folks. So do what you can. Do what you can do. I promised you a RuPaul story. I'll do a RuPaul story. RuPaul's Drag Race has aired to its biggest ever audience. People were so worried because it was moving away from Logo and it was moving to VH1 and it was moving to a Friday night. But no, Friday's premiere of Series 9 got almost 1 million viewers. That's their biggest ever showing. It hauled in 987,000 total viewers, to be precise, which, by the way, probably doesn't even represent the number of people who watched because there's so many viewing parties. But people who tuned in, they saw Lady Gaga. They absolutely saw Lady Gaga. The drag queen-inspired Born This Way singer Lady Gaga had long been rumored for a role on the reality series, and the dream finally came true during the Season 9 premiere last Friday. Lady Gaga took a super serious approach to judging the contest's drag pageant challenge, but fans who skipped Drag Race backstage show Untucked missed out on an extra dose of Lady Gaga as she snuck in to visit the queens. Appearing on Untucked, Lady Gaga let slip some of the emotion she had been feeling during her appearance on the main show. She loved it. People who didn't see it, you should go check it out. I watched it. So enjoyable. In children's books news, we love children's books news, Santa will be in a gay interracial relationship in a new picture book. Who knew? Writer Daniel Kibblesmith said he created the book, a parody in the vein of infamous pre-bedtime read, Go to Sleep. I can't say one of the curse words. He created for his children. Kibblesmith tweeted in December that he and his wife, author Jennifer Ashley Wright, have decided our future child will only know about Black Santa. If they see a white one, we'll say that's his husband. And this week, Kibblesmith, who also writes for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, followed this up with confirmation that a book with this narrative would come out for the holidays. He said this, quote, "I can't believe it, but this is officially happening," and he added that he's very excited. The name of the book is Santa's Husband. It will be about Black Santa and his white husband, who often fills in for him at malls, and it will be produced with Harper Design. The publisher said the book is meant to be read by all ages, and people all over are delighted with the concept. There's so many tweets about it. So, very exciting news there. Let's talk about North Carolina, because God forbid we should do an episode without talking about North Carolina. Another effort to pass legislation to repeal North Carolina's HB2 bathroom bill it has failed. Another attempt has failed. This week, talks between Democrats and Republicans over an agreement to repeal the bill broke down, according to the Star Tribune. The governor of North Carolina earlier in February proposed that a compromise deal should be made to repeal the state's bathroom bill. House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Leader Phil Berger this week said they had agreed to a plan with Governor Roy Cooper to repeal parts of the bill, but leave some provisions intact. But Berger accused Cooper of backing out of the plan. This breakdown comes as the NCAA has threatened to pull athletic events out of the state until 2022 if the bill is not repealed. Some reports are now saying that North Carolina has at this point lost $1 billion. $1 billion. This is not just about discrimination. This is actually hurting businesses in North Carolina. What an absolute waste. There's North Carolina. A gamer story. The lead designer on League of Legends has said that the reason bosses decided to include an LGBT character in their game is as a, quote, reflection of Earth in 2017. This online battle game, League of Legends, will introduce an LGBT playable character. Their developer confirmed that last week. The game is developed and published by Riot Games. It has millions of players around the world. Speaking to a fan site, design director Greg Street confirmed an LGBT character will definitely be added to the game in a future update. He has now responded to a question from a fan on Tumblr who asked about whether game developers feel pressure from liberal politics. And this is what this design director Greg Street said, quote, "For some players like me, it seems really weird when a game doesn't acknowledge that the real world of other gamers or the fictional world of game characters are diverse places with different religions, genders, skin colors, and economic statuses. Having an openly gay character or punishing a player for calling another player a racial slur doesn't feel political to me. It's just a reflection of Earth circa 2017. And so they are saying, this Greg Street, this design director, he's saying a major LGBT playable character. Why do we talk about this? Because this makes a difference. When we see LGBTQ people in all parts of society, it absolutely makes a difference. Representation, good. We like representation. A new study out has found that lesbian and bisexual teens are much more likely to smoke than straight adolescents. The study found that 41% of lesbian or gay teens use tobacco products and 39% of bisexual young people. 32% of youths unsure about their sexual orientation said they smoked, which is compared to 30% of straight teenagers. Again, so straight teenagers, they smoke less. Lesbians were most likely to smoke out of respondents, with more than twice as many saying that they use tobacco products compared to straight girls. Gay teenagers were on average a similar likeliness of smoking than straight boys. The study's lead author said this, quote, "Gender does matter in tobacco use among sexual minority youth." See, when we ask these questions, it's almost like it's illustrating everything that we said earlier in the show. We have to ask these questions about demography because otherwise we don't know how to direct these efforts. If we didn't know that lesbians smoke more than straight teens, then we wouldn't target programs to lesbians, which we should be doing. It's called data-driven decisions. This is what we are supposed to be doing. If we don't collect the information, we can't address things in a solid programmatic way. That's what it comes down to. We need this information. So there's that study. In New York City, a new lawsuit has been filed against the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, alleging that police have unlawfully arrested gay men. The class action lawsuit was filed this week. That is according to the Associated Press. It alleges that police officers with the Port Authority discriminate against men perceived to be gay through false arrests. The lawsuit claims that police officers patrol the bus station bathrooms, attempt to gain the interest of men perceived as gay or bisexual, and then charge them with lewd conduct. What the heck year is it that we're still doing this? It goes on to claim that the arrests are made to boost statistics around quality of life arrests. The lawsuit reads this, quote, The Port Authority Police Department have continued to make such targeted arrests, knowing or believing that most of those arrested will ultimately be forced to plead to lesser charges to avoid public embarrassment and humiliation, costly legal fees and jail sentences, as well as reputational and professional harm associated with false charges. This feels like maybe it's a throwback to, you know, many, many, many decades ago. Can't believe we're still talking about this, but apparently we're still talking about this. So we'll keep our eye on that lawsuit. Hey, Tom Hanks, Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, and Amy Poehler, they're all in the same company. They are all being labeled as having an aggressive gay agenda. Who knew? An evangelical group has accused stars, including Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, and Tom Hanks, of pushing a radical gay agenda. The Liberty Council. That sounds like a noble group. They're not. The Liberty Council made the extraordinary claim after a telethon was announced to raise money for the American Civil Liberties Union, which has led a string of legal challenges against the Trump administration. The event, which will stream via Facebook Live this week, will raise funds for the ACLU's work to hold off the worst of the abuses and challenge unconstitutional and wrong-headed policies and executive orders. All the stars that are appearing, Tina Fey, Tom Hanks, Alec Baldwin, Tracy Morgan, Ellie Kemper, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Titus Burgess, Jane Krakowski, John Hamm, all of them are under fire from the Liberty Council. And the Liberty Council is that law firm that just achieved so much fame and notoriety for representing anti-gay Kentucky clerk Kim Davis. They said this quote, "Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, and Tom Hanks are joining forces to lend their star power to a modern-day telethon benefiting the American Civil Liberties Union. It seems the ACLU's war chest of over $80 million raised since the 2016 elections still isn't enough to advance their leftist agenda. Now they're pulling in Hollywood elitists to put more money in their coffer. Their radical agenda includes an aggressive pro-LGBTQ campaign that includes fighting against any religious liberty protections that they deem to be anti-gay offered by President Trump or Congress. The ACLU is already attempting to overturn President Trump's revocation of the former president's bathroom directive." So there's a radical gay agenda, folks. And you thought it was me that was pushing it? Nope. It's apparently Tom Hanks, Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, and Amy Poehler. Yeah, that's what they're spending time on. Hey, the city of Orlando. The city of Orlando will be marking the upcoming anniversary of the shooting in the Pulse Gay Nightclub. They're going to be holding a day of love and kindness. Just to remind you, 49 innocent people died in the shooting. Many of them were Latino. Holy cow, what a day. I can't believe it's already coming up. The first anniversary of this terrible event is approaching on June 12th, and ahead of the date, the city announced it would mark the event by celebrating love and kindness. The event said this, quote, "The city of Orlando and Orange County government, in collaboration with Pulse, have jointly designated June 12th, 2017 as Orlando United Day, a day of love and kindness. June 12th will be dedicated to honoring the memory of the 49 innocent Pulse victims, supporting survivors, and recognizing the compassion and love that was displayed by the Central Florida community following the tragedy. Orlando United Day is an opportunity to join with others in acts of love and kindness to continue the unity that followed the tragedy. Engaging in these activities on June 12th is a respectful and loving way to remember and honor the lives of those taken and to show compassion to those who need support. To remember the victims and honor the survivors, a number of community events and activities will take place on Monday, June 12th, 2017. So that will be happening in Orlando. Can't believe we're already coming up on a year of that. A few more stories for you. A politician in Arkansas has proposed a bill to further target the transgender community because, again, that's what they have time to spend time on. They're in Arkansas, apparently. Republican Representative Bob Ballinger has proposed that the state's indecent exposure laws be expanded. Under his proposal, it would become illegal to knowingly expose people's genitals to a member of the opposite sex in a public place. The measure, which has already passed in the House in Arkansas, has been accused of being a thinly veiled attempt to stop transgender people from using public bathrooms corresponding to their gender identity. The ACLU of Arkansas, holy cow, is the ACLU busy. The ACLU of Arkansas, they have accused the bill of targeting transgender people. Holly Dixon, the ACLU of Arkansas director, said this, quote, "The bill is intimidating. It can lead to increased harassment. It will chill transgender people's participation in public life. It is creating problems where there are no problems. That's happening in Arkansas. And finally, the most bizarre story of the week, a Texas University student president has been barraged with homophobic threats after the Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, publicly attacked him. Out economics student Bobby Brooks was recently elected as the student president at Texas A&M University. He overcame old-fashioned homophobia in the Lone Star State. Well, former Texas Governor Rick Perry, who we know strongly opposes LGBT rights, he apparently wanted to chime in. And in a newspaper column, he claimed that the election had been stolen outright in favor of Mr. Brooks after another candidate was disqualified for expenses violations. The Trump administration official, Rick Perry, claimed the election was rigged as part of a quest for diversity. It comes out of nowhere. Again, Rick Perry is Donald Trump's energy secretary. And Rick Perry, who wanted to get rid of the Department of Energy, remember that? He wanted to get rid of the Department of Energy, even though he couldn't remember the name of it in that debate years ago. He's chiming in on the student council election? Wait, what? Of a college? It's just lunacy. It's just lunacy. Please stick to learning the name of your department and learning what they do, because he wasn't too clear on that either. And that, my friends, is a whirlwind tour of this week's news. So much going on out there. Again, our huge thanks to everybody over at AIDS United. They are doing such incredible work. Of course, to Jesse Milan. So inspiring. So inspiring that he continues to do this work in such an incredible way. And of course, go to Amazon. Go pick up my book. Seriously, what am I doing here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew. I promise you, you will love the book. Pre-order it. It's coming out on May 23rd. That's it, folks. Get out there. Go use your voice to make a difference for all of our LGBTQ brothers and sisters out there, for all the allies who are supporting us. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Until my ears, I hear your voice, I know you. In your arms I sleep. My love, wherever I go, I take you with me. The journey.